Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download.
On Saturday, Trump held a rally in Memphis, and he said pretty much what you'd expect. So instead of showing the same clips you've seen a million times, it's time for another installment of Trump with no context. Enjoy.
Sheila.
Wow.
Hearing number four into the January 6th Capitol attack gets underway later today, focused on Donald Trump's efforts to pressure state officials into overturning the election. Meanwhile, there is new reporting this morning that Trump's team has found a fall guy. We'll tell you who or what Trump reportedly told confidants about the lawyer who devised the plan to overturn the election.
Mr. Eastman, we hardly knew ye.
It always happens, and they always seem so shocked. Plus, President Biden considers a move to provide a bit of relief at the gas pump, but he needs Congress to agree. We also expect more economic data this morning that could offer clues into whether the U.S. is headed toward a recession. Also, the crippling labor shortage, the latest industry to feel the pressure, airlines, with more chaos and canceled flights. CNBC's Brian Sullivan is standing by to discuss if the lack of labor is as big a threat to the economy as inflation and energy costs.
Would you or a member of your family like to fly a jumbo jet?
Yeah.
If so, have we got a job?
Not
for
that
you?
Easy. That's the problem. It takes so long to become qualified to fly, and there are not pilots, and so often people
it's
are waiting.
Crazy. Yeah.
Or their flights are just literally canceled out underneath them. Good morning, and welcome to Morning Joe. It's Tuesday, June 21st. With us, we have White House Bureau Chief at Politico and the host of Way Too Early, Jonathan Lemire, and Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and associate editor of The Washington Post, Eugene Robinson. Good to have you both on.
You know, Gene, when we were growing up, it was kind of hard to be like, maybe it's because I grew up in a Navy town. I grew up in Pensacola, which was sort of the Annapolis of the air. Everybody there said, I'm going to go serve the country. Then I'm going to fly for Delta or then I'm going to fly for American. Mm-hmm. And it was hard. You know, the guys that were a little slower at the game, you know, they were flying cargo jets. It was straight out of Top Gun. But it was a hard job to get. Now, man, the delays, the chaos in airports across the country are really backed up because a lot of these pilots just quitting. A lot of the flight attendants have had enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And what are you going to do? Because as Mika said, it takes a while to learn to become an airline pilot. And that's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
We want
that's a
to,
good thing.
We want,
yes.
we want them to really know what they're doing.
Yeah,
exactly. So we'll work through this, but I'd rather work through this than a quick fix, I'll tell you.
Exactly. Yes. So we are hours away from the fourth public hearing by the January 6th committee. This afternoon, we're going to hear more about this infamous phone call.
All I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state. So what are we going to do here, folks? I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
That's just unbelievable. That was, of course, Donald Trump talking to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger days before the insurrection, telling him, I need you to steal the election for me. I need you to find, hold on, how many votes are we behind, Gene? We're 11,779 votes behind. So
exactly.
We need 11,780 votes. You know, I've been saying over the past, well, several weeks, but really over the past several months, Donald Trump gets away with absolutely everything. I must say, Georgia, if there's something for him to be worried about, maybe it's not with the Manhattan DA who seems to be scared of his own shadow. Perhaps it's down in Georgia where we've got him on tape saying, I need you, Mr. Secretary of State, to steal the election.
Right. And audio tape, the best friend of the prosecutor, right? You hear, yeah. You hear the former president committing the crime. You have it all on tape. All you need to do is play the tape. So Georgia could really be a problem for him. He could be prosecuted there. And as I said, the evidence is overwhelming. It's dispositive. He's guilty.
Raffensperger is one of three Republicans testifying today. The other two are Raffensperger's top deputy, Gabe Sterling, and Arizona House Speaker Rusty Bowers, who says Trump and Rudy Giuliani called him after the election asking for help to overturn President Biden's victory in the state. We'll also hear from Shay Moss, a former Georgia elections worker. She and her mother were targeted in a debunked voter fraud conspiracy pushed by Giuliani, Trump, and others.
All right. So Mika, this is quite a lineup, which an important lineup when you look at these people. Obviously, the Secretary of State and his assistant were two Republicans who came out with guns blazing. Before anybody else saying, wait a second, these guys are trying to steal the election. We're not going to let them do it. You look at Rusty Bowers. Let's just say what it is in Arizona right now. Arizona's Republican Party has been taken over by the biggest fringe element. They're a bunch of lunatics. They are crazy people. They're weirdos, freaks, conspiracy theorists. And yet you have people like Rusty Bowers. You have other Republicans, people, the Maricopa board that were counting the votes, that time and time again pushed back against the conspiracy theories. These people have done such a great service for America. I would say the same thing for Democrats who, of course, did the right thing. Like Al Gore, for instance, conceding the election when he conceded the election, when he could have, kept fighting that for months and months. And then you have Ms. Moss, Jonathan Lemire, who I'm glad I've seen a picture of her now because I've had way too many people send me emails and send me conspiracy theory posts from Chinese conspiracy websites and Chinese religious cults where they had the conspiracy theory out of Georgia. Oh, there were a box of ballots that they just picked up from underneath the table and they took away. We look at that and we know that's just as stupid as the Jewish space lasers. We know that's just as stupid as all the other conspiracy theories. But you forget there's somebody on the other end of that story who faces death threats because of the lies that all of these conspiracy theorists and crackpots send around.
Yeah, and she and her mother, she's a an election worker, her mother a volunteer, and they were doing their civic duty and staffing the election, and they came under because of a video footage taken of them and allegations, spurious allegations that they were trying to rig the election, as you say, pulling out a box of ballots. None of that true, but it's a theory floated by Rudy Giuliani, then the President Trump's lawyer, and then later Trump himself and other Trump allies on Twitter in media appearances where Ms. Moss and her mother received such scrutiny, they received death threats. And in fact, she has given accounts of a person showing up at her door late at night, banging threateningly, that she would call 911 repeatedly because she was afraid of being followed, that she was afraid that her life was in jeopardy because of these unfounded allegations of election misconduct. There's, again, let's stress, no truth to that whatsoever. But I think for the committee's perspective, she puts a real human face on this to show that the lives changed, altered, and endangered because of these lies.
Absolutely. Well, that's the thing. If you're watching and you send around conspiracy theories like this that target other people, understand you're putting their life at risk. You should know that by now. You look at Pizzagate, the guy that showed up, like ready to shoot the place up because he believed the lies about Hillary Clinton being a pedophile and keeping children hidden in a pizza restaurant in Washington, D.C. Come on, grow up. And I am curious why Ms. Moss and her mother don't sue Rudy Giuliani for lying about them. I mean, the consequences have been pretty devastating for their lives. Let's bring in right now Congressional Investigations reporter for The Washington Post, Jackie Alamani. Jackie, what are we expecting to see today?
Yeah, I think that this topic of political violence, Joe, is going to be a pretty big topic. We already saw Adam Kinzinger get out there on the Sunday shows and say that the death threats against him and his family have increased. And we know as of this morning that lawmakers are actually looking to ramp up their own security. And we're going to hear that from people like Rusty Bowers and Shay Moss, how the former president's false claims of election fraud, which, again, the committee is going to drive home that he knowingly was propagating these false claims, despite being told countless times that there was no there, upended their lives, that the Mosses had to go into hiding, essentially, protect their identity. And it really was a pretty terrifying ordeal for them and continues to this day. Rusty Bowers as well is going to testify to that experience. And then we're going to hear from Brad Raffensperger and Gabe Sterling, who are going to talk about the very explicit pressure campaign that we saw from the former president that is included in audio. But for the first time, we're going to hear directly from them discussing this audio, how that made them feel, what sort of tensions it created, and the toxic political and partisan environment that it contributed to.
Yeah. And I Alex just told me, by the way, Ms. Moss and her mother did sue Giuliani and OAN and get a settlement.
Perfect.
You know, Gene, we're going to continue with the January 6th story. But Jackie just brought up violence. And yesterday I talked a good bit about how Republicans, a certain wing of the Republican Party, the Trump wing of the party especially, are using violent threats, violent imagery and violence itself in a way that shows it's a fascist movement. So before we continue on January the 6th, I want to remind you again, remind our audience again about the comments retired federal judge J. Michael Luttig made last week in the January 6th hearing, saying, quote, Donald Trump and his allies and supporters are a clear and present danger to American democracy. Mm-hmm. Keep that in mind. And I want you to see what a former governor of Missouri, now a Senate candidate, has put out in the new campaign ad that, like 100 other Republican ads this cycle, uses guns and incites violence against his primary opponents. Take a look at this ad.
This is former, former Missouri Governor Eric Reitens, who is vying to fill a vacant Senate seat in the state. And he released the ad yesterday, and we'll just show you video here. He announces that he's going, quote, rhino hunting. Rhino being the acronym for Republicans in name only. Holding a gun. The video depicts an armed Reitens bursting into a house alongside men in tactical gear. He also encourages viewers to, quote, join the MAGA crew and get a rhino hunting permit. Facebook parent company Meta says it removed the video from its sites because it violated rules about violence. Twitter flagged the video, but did not remove it.
So hold on a second. So
yeah, he's
actually
rhino hunting.
We can't show this ad, Gene. I guess. I thought we were going to show this ad. Because it's too violent. You have Greitens going in and kicking down a door with guns and tells everybody to follow him. And Rhino is basically, again, it's what really stupid people call other Republicans who disagree with them. And by the way, stupid people pre-Trump were even calling people rhinos. It's for moderate Republicans or Republicans that disagree with them on the insurrection. But again, here's a guy carrying a gun in with other people and they are hunting out their political opponents. And again, this is fascism. I tried to bring this up, and there are a couple of people that were being polite yesterday going, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't call it fascism. And I don't know whether it's fascism.
My God. Come on.
This is using violence and violent imagery to basically tell people, vote for me. A civil war is coming. It's where we are. It's where the Republican Party is right now. And every Republican needs to call this out unless they want fascism to continue to rise in their party.
Yeah, Benito Mussolini would be proud. And just one question about this. Isn't making terroristic threats a federal crime? I mean, why is this not? I mean, literally, no. You know, I'm like a free speech pretty much absolutist. But this is threatening. He is threatening his primary opponents or anyone who any Republican who dares disagree him with, you know, with assault, with a SWAT team assault that would kill them. I mean, what, you know, this is absolutely impermissible. And there has to be some way this can be sanctioned. This is not right. This is not acceptable in political discourse. This is not legitimate political discourse, as the Republican Party might call it. This is a terrorist.
But this
threat.
Is what they do, Gene. This is what they do. And Mika, we've had several examples. So, you know, there's a member of Congress whose name I'm not going to mention, who was holding an AR-15 and said that we had to go after the squad, and then showed four Democratic congresswomen in the picture as well, basically hunting four members of Congress. And we see this time and time again. Republicans don't call it out. We're seeing it here with the Greitens ad. I would hope Republicans would call this out, but they just don't. So again, I just want to underline again, we're talking about the rise of American fascism. You can look at January 6th. You can look at ads like this. You can look at the continued use of violence and imagery. You can look at Donald Trump telling his audience members to beat people up in the audience that disagree with him. It's fascism.
And this is why, unfortunately, this is the only thing that needs to matter when you're casting your vote, which is very hard to say because this country has a lot of problems and we have a lot of growing pains we still need to go through. We have a lot of issues which we've fallen back on. But right now, this is the issue to vote on. And even Hillary Clinton made that clear. It's either we move forward toward continuing a democracy or we fall into something very dark and very frightening and very real. It's not an exaggeration at this point, especially when you look at how this is pervading our politics from the bottom up. All started pretty much by Donald Trump. There are a lot of other reasons from past presidencies that we got here. We can have that conversation. We can make all that blame. But this is where we are. This is what matters between. It's not Democrat, Republican.
No.
In terms of voting.
No, it's not. And it's not. It is.
It's democracy.
It's a growing wing inside the Republican Party. And it really, again, we can debate abortion. We can debate guns. We can debate interest rates. We can debate quantitative easing. We can debate 1,000 different issues. But for a growing wing of the Republican Party, it's just straight out pro-democracy versus anti-democracy. And you look, whether it's Vladimir Putin, whether it's Orban, or whether it's just fascism, please go on your Google machine and look up the definition of fascism. And whether it was in Germany, whether it's in Italy, wherever it is the pushing aside of democratic norms. The use of violence to do that, the use of violent imagery to do that, the glorification of violence to achieve whatever means necessary, use whatever means necessary to achieve total control and push aside democracy. And it's happened over and over again. And Jonathan Lemire, this is obviously a political battle for Democrats to take part in. But I do keep wondering when the hell there's going to be just one or two Republicans with a national platform that stand up and actively call this out and aggressively go against it and say, this is not who we want to be.
Yeah, we heard from Adam Kinzinger, the Republican congressman, who is often one of the few voices willing to condemn these sort of elements within his party. He, of course, also sits on the January 6th committee, but he's announced he's not running for re-election. So it remains to be seen whether some more powerful voices in the party will condemn this ad, will condemn Greitens' behavior. Greitens, of course, has a very checkered past, forced to resign. There have been allegations against him about domestic abuse. He denies that. And let's also remember, This ad, as horrifying as it would be at any point and in a vacuum, comes amid a backdrop on a national debate on guns. You know, we're just weeks from mass shootings in Buffalo and at a school in Texas. The Senate trying this week to get legislation done on weapons. And this ad comes forward. But as a craven political stunt, it might work. Greitens is in a crowded primary field in Missouri there. It's a state that has trended very, very Republican in recent years. There was this is the effort you make. We're trying to break through. If this is the one thing people are talking about, that might be enough for some Republicans to support him. Of course, other Republicans hope it'll be the exact opposite and people will back away from him because Greitens, because of how toxic his background is, does someone who stands a chance to lose potentially to a Democrat this fall if he's the nominee.
Well, yeah, I mean, it might encourage the fascist wing of the Republican Party. And again, you got to be able to say that without flinching, because that's who he is. That's who the people are that stormed the Capitol. That's who Donald Trump is. People, again, that are inciting violence, encouraging violence, using violent imagery. They also happen to be the same people who are pushing an ethno-nationalist worldview. So, yeah, we'll see. I mean, yeah, again, two things are happening. Missouri's becoming more conservative. Is the Republican there becoming more fascist? I don't think so, but we'll see. If this actually does help Greitens, that's a very bad sign for the people of Missouri. Jackie, let me ask you about today's January 6th hearing also. You talked about violence is going to be a part of it, but also, of course, we're talking about those state legislators. A good example of I talked about Arizona before. We actually had a Supreme Court justice's wife reaching out, asking them to throw out the all the votes in Arizona and send their own set of illegal electors. Do you think we're going to hear about that? Are we going to hear about that in other states as well?
We're definitely going to hear about that. But just to put a pin in this conversation on violence, I think what the committee has understood more so than previous congressional investigations is that facts can't necessarily change minds here, but feelings can, which is why we're seeing such an emphasis on having people like Mrs. Moss come and speak and speak to these intimidation tactics that have a serious chilling effect, not just for people who are potentially running for office, but election workers who are just trying to participate in democracy and the way that these things undermine democracy overall. But the alternate schemes of electors are definitely going to be a big focus today. We're not totally sure if Ginni Thomas is going to be raised at all. We know that was under discussion yesterday amongst committee members. But what we're hearing is that it might actually not be completely relevant to the bigger picture story of John Eastman's legal coup and the implementation of it. Although what Ginni Thomas was doing was obviously in line with this ploy that John Eastman was proposing to the former president, along with state legislatures, and I think we're going to hear a lot about how the pressure was really overwhelming on these state players to submit phony slates of electors in order to halt the electoral certification or at least apply pressure on the vice president to send it back to the state legislatures to sort of actually implement the president's plan to overturn his defeat.
Wow. The Washington Post, Jackie Elimeny, thank you very much. We'll see you again real soon as we watch these hearings scheduled for today. To the economy now. President Biden says he may call on Congress to suspend the federal gas tax, a move that could save drivers as much as 18 cents per gallon. White House officials say the administration hopes to offer relief in time for the busy July 4th holiday weekend because a gas tax holiday requires congressional action. One White House official acknowledges it would be a challenge. Let's bring in CNBC's Brian Sullivan. Brian, for that, on top of whatever everything else that's going on with the economy, would this help and why wouldn't it get through Congress?
It wouldn't hurt. It's 18 cents. I mean, and by the way, that would assume that the local gas station owner, the marketers, refiners, distributors, that they passed it along to you. I mean, local gas station owner, he may just keep that 18 cents a gallon. Who knows? It can't hurt. A state gas tax holiday maker would probably be a little more effective given that state gas taxes tend to be a lot higher, particularly in California and Pennsylvania and places like that. 18 cents a gallon is probably, I don't, maybe $20 or $30 a month for most people, but the price of gas has already gone up about $2 a gallon from last year. You asked, will it get through? Probably not. Because remember, the federal gas tax goes to pay for roads. So there's estimates that if you suspend it for a month, maybe call that $15 billion, that's money that's going to have to be repaid anyway by taxpayers to go into road funds. So will it happen? We'll see. Will it help? Probably not much.
Right.
Yeah. Let me ask you about labor, the issue of labor, obviously an ongoing crisis. There seems to be a labor shortage everywhere you look. We've been talking about the airlines, but you also have so many other people that talk about recruiting top talent and telling them when the start date is, and then they just don't show up. Talk about the labor crunch and how it's impacting the economy.
Well, it's impacting the airports in a big way. And by the way, I mean, airlines laid people off, gave early retirement during the pandemic, and now they're desperate for people to come back. Why would they? I don't know. The airports are a complete disaster. 6,000 canceled or delayed flights around America over the weekend. By the way, I tweeted out a picture. We had an issue with Delta. We used the app to find out about a delayed flight. It said estimated wait time, 697 minutes. Joe, that's 11 and a half hours. It was 5:30 in the morning yesterday, but still 11 and a half hours. It was only four. So we feel like we got lucky. Listen, whether it is the airline industry, Pete Buttigieg had his flight canceled from D.C. to New York on Friday. The Department of Transportation secretary ended up driving from D.C. to New York on Friday because if you're Pete Buttigieg and your flight doesn't take off, what does that mean for the rest of us? Listen, labor force participation rate down by about 1%. I know it doesn't sound like a lot, Mika, but 1% on an economy of over 100 million workers is more than a million people. And it is a serious risk to the economy longer term. If you can't grow the economy, the economy either stalls or contracts because you have to pay those people willing to work more, which is wage inflation, no growth. Higher inflation is that ugly word, Joe, stagflation. Let's hope we don't get there.
Boy, let's hope not.
CNBC's Brian Sullivan, thank you very much for coming on this morning. We appreciate it. And still ahead on Morning Joe, a spokesman for Vladimir Putin says he can't guarantee two U.S. military veterans captured in Ukraine won't face the death penalty. We'll have the new NBC News exclusive interview with Dmitry Peskov, plus some of the strongest remarks yet from a Western official in regards to Russia. Why a top European Union diplomat is accusing Moscow of a war crime. Also this morning, more questions surrounding the police response to the Uvalde shooting. A new report finds officers armed with rifles and at least one ballistic shield were in the school 19 minutes after the gunman. So why didn't they act sooner? They had the shield. Plus, Democratic Senator Chris Coons will join us to discuss where the new bipartisan gun safety legislation stands on Capitol Hill. A lot going on this morning. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Welcome back to Morning Joe. It's 31 past the hour. We're hearing for the first time from the Kremlin about two U.S. military veterans who were captured on the front lines in Ukraine by Russia. In an NBC News exclusive interview, senior international correspondent Keir Simmons pressed Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin's press secretary,
about their fate. We should note that Russia is cracking down on journalists and limiting what they can say under the threat of imprisonment.
The Kremlin's first comments after two American veterans on the front lines in Ukraine were captured by pro-Russian forces.
Russian television has broadcast interviews with two Americans captured in Ukraine, Alex Struki and Andy Wen. Where are they? Who is holding them? And what happens next?
They're soldiers of fortune, and they were involved in illegal activities on the territory of Ukraine. They were involved in firing and shelling our military personnel. They were endangering their life. They should be held responsible for those crimes that they have committed.
In an exclusive interview, I asked Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov about the two British nationals and a Moroccan captured by separatist rebels in Ukraine, now sentenced to death.
Can you guarantee that these Americans will not face the same fate?
No, I cannot guarantee anything. It depends on the investigation.
And we asked about another American being held in Russia, WNBA star Brittany Griner, who was detained at the airport in February, accused of carrying vape cartridges with hashish oil.
She was coming to take part in sport in Russia, effectively trying to build bridges through sport. It's a terrible message, isn't it, that she should be arrested?
It is also a terrible message to bring some forbidden essences and materials to this country. And it is prosecuted by Russian laws.
The special presidential envoy for hostage affairs is now leading the U.S. effort to secure Brittany Griner's release. So the U.S. government is now approaching this as a hostage situation.
I would strongly disagree with that. We cannot call her hostage. She violated Russian law. And now she is being prosecuted.
NATO leaders now warning of a long conflict in Ukraine. It may be one view Russia agrees on.
Are we in for a long conflict here?
Yes, it will be a long-lasting crisis. We will never trust West anymore.
Wow, really we'll compelling interview and a really fine line that Keir was walking there, given the constraints for reporters. But Joe, what do you think of this overall? Because we have these two Americans who are fighting for Ukraine, plus this basketball star.
Well, let's just talk generally about what's been going on. And by the way, the Russians, if you work, I guess, for the Russian government, it is a requirement that you lie through your teeth. It's what they've done. It's what they're doing. It's what they've always done. And we'll never trust the West again. Please, please. You have the Russians who have lied over and over again about their intentions with Ukraine, over and over again about launching a war. Committing war crimes left and right.
Atrocities.
And I will say, and the atrocities, I've got to say, I have agreed with the Biden administration to this point, and with the bright red line that has been drawn between the Polish border and the Ukrainian border. But I've got to say, at this point in the war, Gene, we see most of the fighting going on in the east. I'm not so sure the United States shouldn't do what it did in Syria when Vladimir Putin was going around bombing hospitals there. I'm not so sure we shouldn't work with an international organization and establish a humanitarian zone that reaches across Western Ukraine, protects Ukrainians, place where they know they can go. And if it takes in Kyiv, it takes in Kyiv. And at some point, just let Vladimir Putin know he's not going to establish the boundaries of this war, and he's not going to be able to continue to commit war crimes without paying a price.
Well, you know, that's I get that, and that's difficult to implement. It's but you are right that this phase of the war is different from the first phase, and now that the Russians are just basically killing people, pounding targets for no reason. They lob a rocket into Kyiv just because they feel like it. They no real military objective, and and can do this sort of thing indefinitely. Now that they are taking hostages in the way that they have that we've just talked about, it's I guess it's time for a kind of continual rethink of our strategy. It's hard to think of exactly how you implement this humanitarian corridor without running the risks that the Biden administration says it doesn't want to run, which is direct conflict between the United States and Russia. I know that's not something anybody wants to see, except maybe Vladimir Putin, because he seems to be pushing things in that direction. And there is a breaking point. I'm not sure we've reached that breaking point yet, or that tipping point. But this is going to be awful. This is going to be awful for months, yes, and potentially years.
Well, which is why, Jonathan Lemire, Joe Biden was in the Obama administration when they kept saying we can't do anything with Syria, when 10,000 Syrians died, said we can't do anything when 50,000 Syrians died, when 100,000 Syrians died, said it's just too complicated. When 200,000 Syrians died, they said, no, we just can't go in. When 400,000 Syrians died, said, yeah, it's just beyond our reach. We just don't know what to do. 500,000 Syrians die, they don't go in. We do have some troops in Syria now. We did set up a humanitarian zone. The Russians charged 2,500 of our troops, and about 100 of them got killed in 5 minutes. there is no reason why we can't go in peacefully with other allies, set up a security zone in Western Ukraine, and let the Russians know we are just here, allowing refugees to come, be in their own country, and this zone is secured. Do not cross this red line, and let him threaten World War III. All he wants to threaten World War III. If we're not going there offensively, but just going there to provide humanitarian assistance, then, it might be something that we have to look at, Jonathan. I'm curious, what's the White House plan for the next week, the next month, the next 6 months, the next year? Is it just going to be more of the same?
Well, the war has evolved enough to this point that we shouldn't discount anything. But at the moment, Joe, there aren't discussions to have a zone like that. In fact, the president continues to say that it is a line he will not cross to deploy U.S. troops into Ukraine in any way, shape, or form. In fact, he was been pretty stern this week about how he doesn't want American ex-military or volunteers to be over there either. And now we've seen a few people capture reports last night of a second American killed during the combat who was fighting on the Ukrainian side. The focus at this point remains shoring up alliances and pushing money and weapons and supplies to the Ukrainians. And that's going to be the president's focus when he heads overseas next week. He leaves Saturday for a pair of crucial summits, the meeting of the G7, the wealthiest nations in the world. That'll be in Germany, and then on to NATO in Spain. I'll be on that trip with the president, bringing reporting here for the show. And the president's mission is going to be to rally those members, to rally those nations, say, look, this war is in a difficult new phase. It's going to be a bloody, brutal conflict there in the East for potentially months and maybe years. And that's what Putin's betting on, is that the Western attention will wane, that the Western commitment to giving money and weapons will falter, and that he can outlast them and eventually take bigger, bigger pieces of Ukraine. President Biden's mission is to prevent that. And he's going to try to rally the countries in the G7. He's going to try to rally these NATO members, as well as get Finland and Sweden in to try to assuage Turkey's concerns there, to bolster that alliance. That's going to be his mission. And that is center focus for this White House, is to keep Ukraine well-equipped for a battle that may rage for a very long time.
Well, and that is Vladimir Putin's bet, Mika, and it is up to Joe Biden. It is up to NATO. It is up to the EU. And it is up to those who still want to defend democracy and freedom to make sure he loses that bet.
Yeah, we're going to have more on the war in Ukraine ahead. Russia is promising to retaliate against a member of NATO.
You see, that would, and let me just, as a public service announcement to Vladimir Putin, let me just tell you, that doesn't end well for you.
No,
No, it doesn't. We're going to explain Lithuania's role in blocking a vital pipeline for Russian goods. Plus, we'll lay out the latest timeline on the police response to the Uvalde school shooting. Former New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton will be our guest coming up on Morning Joe.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Here on MSNBC, we are staying on top of several fast-moving stories.
Today's news requires more facts.
A new report finds the climate crisis is getting much worse.
More context.
We are seeing record numbers of people crossing into the United States just in the southern border.
And more ground covered.
The mission will continue to carry out regime change in the Gaza Strip.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
45 past the hour, we have yet more disturbing new reporting on the school massacre in Uvalde,
Texas. It's unbelievable, Mika. It's unbelievable.
Documents reviewed by the Austin American Statesman reveal police officers were inside the school, armed with high-powered rifles and the first ballistic shield at 11:52 a.m. So that's 19 minutes after the gunman entered the school. But they didn't breach the door to take him down. For another hour, for 58 more minutes. This photo from the Texas Tribune shows at least two ballistic shields on the scene at 12:04, just about 1 minute
after. I'm sorry,
after.
What the hell? What the hell were they doing? What the hell was their on-site leader telling them to do?
Well, that's the issue, actually. One minute after a student called 911 from inside the classroom pleading for help, officers still didn't enter the classroom for another 46 minutes. The new revelation contradicts the statement from police that officers didn't have the proper equipment to confront the killer. The Statesman reports that officers grew increasingly impatient. This is important, Joe. One of them saying, if there's kids in there, we need to go in there. Another responded, whoever's in charge determines that. A transcript of body camera footage from officers showed the commander on the scene, Uvalde School Police Chief Pete Arredondo, was trying to find keys to open the classroom door, even though officials say they do not believe officers had tried to open the door. NBC News has not been able to verify the documents. A lawyer for Arredondo did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the reports last night. He has defended his actions on that day and has previously said we responded to the information that we had and had to adjust to whatever we faced. And Joe, I know we're going to bring in Bill Bratton, but just to the point that you're making about police in general being afraid to go in, I honestly think when it comes out, when you listen to all the body camera video possible, you're going to hear from a lot of cops that would have done anything to get the
well, the cops wanted to go in.
They will live with that for the rest of their lives.
It's what you're saying. A lot of the cops wanted to go in, but they had the guy on the scene telling them to hold back, fumbling around,
looking for keys. And following orders everything.
He was just stalling. I was going to say he was killing time. Well, while there were kids inside that were bleeding out, that were calling 911, that were dying, that could have been saved if he had done his job. Let's bring in right now former New York City Police Commissioner, now the executive chairman of Tenio Risk, Bill Bratton. His new book, an important book for every politician in America to read, The Profession, a memoir of community, race, and the arc of policing in America. It's out in paper book. I say every politician, also every police chief, and the rank and file. There's so much important in here, Mr. Commissioner. I want to start, though, you know, we've talked about Uvalde. We've talked about all the ways they screwed up. Let's just do a reset here. Post-Columbine, there are rules of engagement for school shooters that we see one police department after another fail on. Could you explain to us post-Columbine, if there is an active shooter inside a school, what is every police department supposed to do?
The general philosophy, Joe, is that you go in. One officer, two officers, three officers, that you go in. Quite clearly, that did not happen here. We're going to have to wait for the results of the special commission that's been formed to examine this incident, similar to what's going on in Congress right now about January 6th, because these drips of information coming out just infuriate us all. The idea that they had ballistic shields, they had a device, the other day there's a report, they had a device that would have popped that door. There's no explaining it other than a total failure of lack of leadership and command and control. And command and control in policing is absolutely essential. Unity of command. Literally everything we trained for seemed to have been violated in this instance.
Also talking about transparency. I mean, you know, they lied and they hid behind the grieving parents in that press conference where all those guys were up on the stage and Beto O'Rourke went in there. They lied talking about doing everything and don't use grief against these parents. Then you had the police chief doing the same thing when confronted by NBC News. But like you said, it's drip. One lie after another lie after another lie exposed as the days go by. Talk about why it is so important for police departments to be transparent up front.
Ironically, Joe, I teach a class with John Miller, who's very known to you, the deputy commissioner of the NYPD, every year, twice up in Boston with 300 police leaders from around the country on communication skills. And the most important word in police communications is preliminary. The first story is never the last story, and that's clearly the case in this instance. And the idea is to, as quickly as possible, get out what you know, but understand that the story is going to change. And the frustration here is that we trained so much for this. This department actually trained for this and apparently failed when it came time to actually deal with it. We're going to learn a lot, I think, as this committee that's been formed issues its report. And policing is always an evolution. In my book, I write about the evolution of policing. Yeah. We're constantly learning and changing. We learn from Columbine. We will learn from this.
So yesterday I had a friend of mine on who's a former CIA case officer. He was talking about the problems with morality. He's been doing God's work, driving around in some of the toughest parts of Philly, just to try to figure out the challenges that that department is facing. I know you watched the segment, you heard the segment, and you agree with so much of what he says. Talk about the challenges that our men and women in blue are facing, whether it's in Philadelphia, whether it's in Los Angeles, New York, Miami, or in the United States Capitol, unfortunately.
They are extraordinary challenges, and that's what I write about in the book. And in fact, the book now has an epilogue to incorporate the events of January 6th. I felt it so important to talk about that impact. Let's face it, Joe, I think you understand on this show that but for the Capitol Police and Metropolitan Police on January 6th, the indispensable institution, as your guest yesterday described them, we would have lost our democracy on that day, but for the actions of the police. And so that the essential nature of policing in our democracy, it can't be denied. But policing has to be centrist, can't be to the left, can't be to the right. And that's the challenge, to stay center. And it's an extraordinary challenge, particularly when so much of our political leadership is so far to the left, so far to the right. You talked earlier about the Republican Party is becoming a party of anarchists, basically. But the Democratic Party also, particularly the progressive left, is creating phenomenal fear in America through many of their policies, where effectively they're enabling criminals rather than preventing crime. So we're in a very strange place in America at the moment, and American policing is so often the case, we are in the middle, with a man in the arena, as Theodore Roosevelt described them when he was police commissioner in New York back in the early 1900s. Challenging times for our country, challenging times certainly for American policing.
You know, what I find so fascinating is that after George Floyd's tragic death, Republicans started accusing Democrats of wanting to defund the police. I've had Nancy Pelosi on. I've had Democratic leaders all across the political spectrum come on And they all say the same thing. And Jim Clyburn has, from the very start, has said, no, 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 don't defund the police. We need more police officers. And that's something that Reverend Al, a guy you know very well, haven't always agreed with him. He hasn't always agreed with you. But he's always talking about we need more police officers. We need reform, yes. But we need more police officers, not less. We need more policing, not less. We're hearing that from the mayor of Washington, D.C. We're hearing that from other mayors who 2 years ago were talking about defunding the police. So here's my question. We hear this, and yet you look at New York City where Eric Adams has come in, and he wants to empower the police. He wants to give the police more opportunity to stop the crime and to stop the murders in some of the most crime-addled areas in New York City. And yet it's other politicians on the far left who are stopping him. So I'm trying to figure out how we square this. How does the Democratic Party effectively balance the safety of its most disadvantaged citizens? Because let's face it, our neighborhoods, we're not facing the great challenges. The great challenges are being faced by the truly disadvantaged in New York City and across America. So the question is, how do Democrats effectively balance the need for more cops, more safety, at the same time, more reform?
I'm not optimistic about that, Joe. You reference Eric Adams. He is an uphill battle against the legislature, the city council, the attorney general. Literally everybody else in the criminal justice system is going in a different direction than he is. New York is a city living in fear. The fear is growing throughout every neighborhood in the city. And as much as Eric is trying to walk the walk and talk the talk, as fast as he's walking in the other direction, the progressive left is going in the other direction. They are effectively enabling the criminals with the reforms that they put in place and, in many respects, disarming the police. There is no support for police from the political establishment in New York City and New York State, with the exception of the mayor and one or two of the district attorneys. Unless they get smart and turn it around, they're going to get wiped out in November, certainly. In a couple of years down the line, they'll get wiped out in elective offices at the state and local level, because the fear is going to grow as the crime is growing. And I'm an optimist, but for New York at the moment, I'm not too optimistic, unfortunately.
We're going through a really hard time. And Commissioner, if you will, if you could stay with us, we're going to sneak in a break here. And also still ahead, we've got Georgia on our mind. Georgia's Secretary of State will testify before the January 6th committee today about former President Trump's push to change the state's 2020 election results. It's also primary day in the Peach State. We'll dig into what's at stake in today's runoffs.
By the way, I've just got to say, this is top-notch producing.
Oh, yeah.
You tease Ray Charles, and then you play it. I'm just hoping we have a picture of Georgia. Oh, no. New York. Never mind.
Morning, Joe. We'll be right back.
I just wanted the Masters.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.